I'm going to continue on with the greater discourse on the destruction of craving. This is right after we went through all the questionnaires of on the cessation of suffering. Monks knowing and seeing in this way, would you run back to the past thus? Were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what did we become in the past? No, venerable sir, why would you not think about things in the past? Because you're cognizing what's happening in the present. You're staying with what you see in the present. You haven't got time for speculation. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you run forward to the future thus? Shall we be in the future? Shall we not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? No, venerable sir. Why? Same answer. Don't have time for analyzing or trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future. Actually, it's a waste of time. You can plan what you're going to do when you get off retreat, who you're going to see and what you're going to say, and it doesn't even come close. So that's just a waste of time and getting caught in restlessness. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you be inwardly perplexed about the present thus? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Come from? Where will it go? Again, that's just restless mind trying to figure things out. So you six are all of these kind of questions. No, venerable sir. Monks, knowing and seeing in this way, would you speak thus? The teacher is respected by us. We speak as we do out of respect for the teacher. No, venerable sir. Why? Because you are your own teacher. Knowing and the seeing in this way, would you speak thus? The recluse says this, and we speak thus at the bidding of the recluse. No. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you acknowledge another teacher? No. Why? You're your own teachers. You're teaching yourself how to let go of things and see things as they truly arise. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you return to the observances, tumultuous debates, and auspicious signs of ordinary recluses and Brahmins, taking them as taking them as the core of the holy life? No, venerable sir. Do you speak only of what you have known, seen, and understood for yourselves? Yes, venerable sir. Good monks, so you have been guided by me with this Dhamma, which is visible here and now. Immediately effective. inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. For it was with reference to this that it was said, "Monks, this Dhamma is visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves." And again, we have this word wise in there, which means seeing the links of dependent origination. The round of existence, conception to maturity. Monks, the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. Here there is the union of the mother and father, but the mother is not in season, and the coming being is not present. In this case, no descent of the embryo takes place. There's a union of the mother and father, and the mother is in season, but the coming being is not present. In this case, too, no descent of the embryo takes place. But when there is the union of the mother and father, and the mother is in season, and the coming being is present, through the union of these three things, the descent of the embryo takes place. In Burma, there was a story about this man and wife went to a party, and they were going to kill a young calf for the food. And the woman said, "It's a shame that they're going to kill this young calf. They should let it grow to full growth." And the calf heard that and became attached to that woman. Shortly after that, she got pregnant, and he was reborn as a human being because of his attachment to that woman. The mother then carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. 9 months is the sun calendar, 10 months is the moon calendar. In Burma, they go by the moon calendar. So they have 13 months a year, and they have 4 or 5 days that are non-days. And that's when New Year's is. That's when all of the, or not all, but a lot of the monks, a lot of the laymen become monks for that period of time, and then they disrobe and go back to. So there's a lot of real heavy-duty activity in the New Year. At the monastery I was staying at, in one day they ordained 300 10 preceptors that were women, and 200 monks and samanera. The samanera were young boys from the age of, around 7 to around 12. But that was the time that the monks took time to get them all aside and start teaching. This is what Buddhism is. And the head monk, he gave a Dhamma talk that lasted about 5 hours. And they all sat, and this is like the hottest time of the year. I mean, it was 105 if it was anything. And you put all these people in a huge room, and the weather in the room is real hot and humid. Really uncomfortable. Then at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the noble one's discipline. Why that is, I haven't got a clue. When he grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays at such games as toy plows, tip cat, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures. This says toy cars, and I wonder what a car looked at like during the time of the Buddha. So I changed that to carts. And a toy bow and arrow. When he grows up, his faculties mature still further. The youth enjoys himself provided and endowed with the 5 cords of sensual pleasure. With forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and inviting lust. With sounds cognizable by the ear that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and inviting lust. Odors cognizable by the nose that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and inviting lust. Flavors cognizable by the tongue that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and inviting lust. Tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and providing lust. On seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it if it's pleasing. He dislikes it if it's unpleasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished, with a limited mind, and he does not understand as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein these evil unwholesome states cease without remainder. Now, one of the things that's really not very well understood in this country is mindfulness of the body. There are people that teach mindfulness of the body, but that's a different kind of meditation that they're talking about. You're talking about not being able to see the tension and tightness in your head, because when the mindfulness of the body is unestablished, you have a limited mind. And he does not understand as it actually is how there is the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein evil and wholesome states cease without remainder. So that means that he's being caught up in craving, and he's not seeing how things actually do work. Engaged as he is in favoring and opposing, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, he delights in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, delight arises in him. Now, delight in feeling is craving. With craving as condition, clinging arises. With clinging as condition, habitual tendency comes to be. With habitual tendency as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with mind, he lusts after it if it's pleasing. He dislikes it if it's unpleasing. Now, delight in feeling is craving. With his craving as condition, clinging comes to be. With clinging as condition, habitual tendency comes to be. With habitual tendency as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, awakened and blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. With the right meaning and phrasing, he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. A householder or householder's son, or one born in some other clan, hears the Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Possessing that faith, he considers thus: household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It's not easy while living in a home to lead a holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. So, suppose I shave off my hair and beard and put on a yellow robe and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or large fortune, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard and puts on the yellow robe and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth and possessing amongst training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings. With rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious, merciful, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given. Taking only what is given, expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, he abstained from celibacy. He observed celibacy. Living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. Abandoning false speech, he abstained from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable. One who is no deceiver of the world. abandoning malicious speech. He abstained from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus, he is one who reunites those who are divided. A promoter of friendship, he enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many and agreeable to many. That means cut out the cursing, the foul language. Abandoning gossip, he abstains from gossip. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and discipline. At the right time, he speaks such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. He abstains from injuring seeds and plants. He practices eating only one meal a day, abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. He abstains from dancing, singing, and music. He abstains from wearing garlands, smartening himself with scent, and embellishing himself with unguents. He abstains from high and luxurious couches. He abstains from accepting gold and silver. He abstains from accepting raw grain. He abstains from accepting raw meat. He abstains from accepting women and girls. During the time of the Buddha, if a man was married and had children, and the man died, they were kicked out of the house. They were not in the family anymore. And they didn't have any place to go, so they tried to take the women and girls and take them to monasteries to have the monks take care of them. But we can't do that. He abstains from accepting men and women slaves. Interesting thing in Burma, the word they use for me or I is debido. And debido literally means this slave. And when there was a king, everybody did exactly what the king said. It didn't matter whether they agreed with it or not, because they were considered a slave. He abstains from accepting goats and sheep. He abstains from accepting fowl and pigs. He abstains from accepting elephants, cattle, horses, and mares. He abstains from accepting land and fields. He abstains from running errands and running messages. He abstains from buying and selling. He abstains from false weights, false metals, and false measures. He abstains from accepting bribes, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. He abstains from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder, and violence. He becomes content with robes to protect his body and alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, So too the monk becomes content with robes to protect his body and alms food to maintain his stomach. Wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil and unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. Now, what does this mean? On seeing a sight, you don't grasp at its signs and features. Does this mean you don't look at things that are beautiful? No, it doesn't mean that. What it means is if you want to look at something and you begin to think about it, you 6R and come back and look at it. Because when you see something, you start thinking about it, then you think about something else, and then you think about something else, and you don't even know you have a body at that time. All you know is you have a mind, and it's off in the ethers thinking about this and that when you're trying to look at a flower. So what you do is you 6R so that you don't get caught up in that. And that is how you guard the eye faculty. If you don't guard the eye faculty, evil and unwholesome states might invade you. And that means identifying with all of your thoughts and all of your feelings and taking them personally. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He understands the restraint of the eye faculty. On hearing a sound with the ear, same thing. On smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with body, on cognizing a mind object with mind, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left one of these faculties unguarded, evil, unwholesome states might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the faculties. He undertakes the restraint of the faculties. Possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied. Why? Because he doesn't allow craving to come in and distract him away. He becomes one who acts with full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Full awareness of what? I just read you a whole list.
Surely that craving does not arise.
Yeah, that's right, but you have to be a little bit more explicit. While you're doing these actions, you watch what mind is doing. And did you notice that it said, while you're eating, drinking, and consuming food, what do I want you to do when you're doing that? Radiate your object to meditation. Isn't that something? And while you're going to the bathroom, what do you do with your mind? Stay with your object of meditation. It says it doesn't matter whether you're walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, or keeping silent. What do? You six are. And stay with your object of meditation. Yeah.
I have a question, Bhante. So professionally, when you're doing your work, like I design gardens, so I'm having to think and visualize, how would I stay present and not
can
go down?
Can you smile? I don't know if you remember, but I told you that when you smile, you are practicing the Eightfold Path at that time.
So just work with a smile on my face?
That's right.
If it gets me out of my smile, then it's all
right. You're right.
Okay.
Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, a wide open space, a heap of straw. On returning from his alms round after his meal, he sits down. Now this is where Bhikkhu Bodhi says, folding his legs crosswise means sitting on the ground with your legs crossed. That's not applicable to this culture. And you notice that almost everybody sits in a chair while they're meditating, because you need to be comfortable. During the time of the Buddha, the only people that had any furniture at all were the kings, the rulers, the very, very wealthy people. So everybody sat on the floor, and they sat cross-legged, so they were used to it. And actually, their hips turned a little bit more than our hips do. So it was very comfortable for them to sit for long periods of time on the floor with their legs crossed. But we sit in chairs. And when you try to sit on the floor for any length of time, what happens? Ow. A lot of pain arises. The whole point of meditation is not to make pain arise. It is to watch how mind moves. So you don't have to sit in a way that causes pain to arise. Sit as comfortably as you can. And if you need to adjust your sitting so that your arms are up a little bit higher, or your feet are up a little bit higher, or you need a cushion in your back, use it. Just don't lean heavily into it. Okay? So I don't agree with folding his legs crosswise and setting his body erect. You can have your body be erect in a chair, but don't pick an over-comfortable chair if you're at home. A lazy boy doesn't work for meditation. abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness, that is greed, wanting. Getting caught up and wondering what's happening outside in the world. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will and hatred. Compassionate for all living beings, he purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor. Mindful and fully aware, he purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Now, I already told you, you better be good friends with sloth and torpor. What's happening here? This happened again. Is that going to stay there? We'll see. You better become friends with sloth and torpor, because it's going to be coming around occasionally until you become an arahat. You better be able to recognize it so you can see for yourself. After you get to a certain degree of depth in your practice, you're not going to have sleepiness so much. You're going to have torpor. Your mind is going to get just dull out. And you need to be able to recognize when either restlessness or sloth and torpor arises. If there's restlessness, you need to back off with the amount of energy you're using to stay with your object of meditation. If you start to dull out, you have to pick up your energy a little bit. When I say a little bit, I mean that much. Not very much at all. You don't want to go in big leaps and bounds. You get sleepy and all of a sudden your head's bobbing, and then you see that and you straighten up real straight and you say, I'm not going to get sleepy anymore, and then you start slumping again because you're trying to put too much in at one time. Put in small. Is that better? Oh, yeah, it is better. I can hear it. Excuse me. So you want to adjust little bits at a time, not try to hit it up. And you cause yourself a lot more problems when you do that. So just adjust a little bit, not quite enough. Okay, do it again. But the whole point of the hindrances is for you to be able to recognize them when they arise and use the six R's. Don't get involved in the story. The story is going to cause you nothing but problems. You have fear, anxiety, depression, whatever it happens to be. If you have depression, that seems to be one of the favorites right now. How does it arise? What happens first? What happens after that? What happens after that? Depression arises. There's a painful feeling that arises. I don't like that painful feeling. I have all kinds of ideas and concepts and opinions and stories about why I don't like that feeling. And then I try to use my thoughts to control the feeling. And the more you think about it, the more emotional you get, the more you want to close all the windows and tell everybody, leave me alone, I'm depressed. And you do that for a little bit, and then you run to the doctor so you can get some medicine that dulls you out. And that doesn't work very well. But when you see these links of dependent origination that I just told you about, and you relax into it, and you don't take that painful feeling as yours personally. It's not yours. You didn't ask it to come up. It's just a painful feeling. When you relax into that and use the six R's, you won't have this concept of depression arising anymore. I worked at a in Malaysia. I worked in a mental institute for a little while. And one of the things that I took from the Buddha's teaching is meditation. The start of meditation is practicing your generosity. And especially in Asia, they say, oh, he's out of his mind. And that's not true. That's not the way it works. You're going into your mind so much that you don't know how to react to things outside of your mind. So what I did was I had some people with some dirty clothes, and I took his dirty clothes and I gave it to somebody else to clean. I said, can you help him? And they started coming out. And I would take somebody else's and give it to somebody else. And before long, these people started understanding more how mind worked by practicing their generosity. And of course, I would try to get them to understand it's really important to keep the precepts without breaking them. But I was there for about a month, actually, and the psychiatrist started to get real jealous because I was starting to show people how to be healthy, and they asked me not to come anymore. That's okay. I made the point to the psychiatrist, because I was talking to them about it, and they weren't going for it. No, we have to give them drugs. That's the only way to control these people. And everybody that has to take these drugs, they hate them, because they walk around like a zombie. But I was showing the psychiatrist how to do it without any drugs at all. And it got to be too intimidating, so what can you do? Life is supposed to be fun. You're supposed to laugh with things. You remember when you were a little kid? You're laughing and giggling all the time, and that you had a sense of wonder. And you were happy. and you wanted to know how everything works. Well, who told us when we started growing up and getting older that you can't do that anymore? I'd like to catch a hold of that person and thump them around the head and shoulders. Have fun. Smile. Laugh. You're following the Eightfold Path. And that leads to what? Freedom. Happiness. Not only for you, but for other people around you. It's really a necessary part of life that almost everybody forgets, and they get so serious. And they're causing themselves immeasurable amounts of suffering. Well, you have a choice. You can do that or not. I like to laugh, personally. It makes my body feel good. I don't like to get grumpy because it hurts. What I'm showing you on this retreat is how to do that. You start with something very simple. Smile. Smile as much as you can. Why? Because it helps joy to arise. Corners of your mouth are important. When the corners of your mouth go down, so does your mental state. Corners of your mouth go up, so does your mental state. It's simple. The more you can smile and have fun, the easier life becomes. But you start thinking about, I got to go to work, and I don't really like this job, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that. And you forget to smile. So I want everybody to smile all the time. So you start getting in the habit of doing that. So your mind has joy arise. When I was practicing straight vipassana in Burma, and I'd have a little bit of joy arise, it was such a relief because there was so much suffering around. I'd go to the teacher and he'd see me smiling. What are you doing in your meditation? Oh, I got some joy. It's really good. This is why I wanted to do the meditation. Don't be attached. Well, I didn't want to be attached. So I'd start pushing that joy away. No. Joy is one of the awakening factors. It's really important that you experience joy. When you have joy arise in your mind is very alert, your mind is very agile. You can start to see when you lose that smile and that joy and your mind starts to get heavy. So it improves your mindfulness because you see it more quickly. I have a student in Gainesville. She's a lawyer, public defender. Came and did a retreat. Goes back to work, and she's smiling and happy and kind to people. And her boss called her into the office and said, "You have to get more angry." What? You have to have more hatred so you can be a good lawyer. So now she's looking for another job. She wants to teach instead of be a lawyer. And I can certainly agree with that. But having a boss tell me, you got to have hatred in your mind. What are you doing? Whoa. No. That's not good. But that's the way things are these days. People cultivate that anger and hatred. Why is there so much fighting in the world? Why is there so much lying in politics? They want to get advantage. You can always get advantage and make people afraid of you, and then you're on top of them. You can control them that way. I don't want to control anybody. I just want to see people smile and be happy. And the more you can do that, the more you do affect the world around you. Don't get caught up in your hatreds and lusts for things. You need to practice the Eightfold Path all the time. That smiling mind, that gentle mind. When you keep your precepts without breaking them, you will get a reputation for being honest. Do you know how hard that is to get a reputation for being honest? Because people like to say things, oh, I'm a salesman, I can't be honest. I can't be successful. Well, yes, you can. When you get a reputation for being honest, people will start breaking down your door because they know they can trust what you're saying. And it's a real important aspect of living. Abandoning restlessness and anxiety abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. Doesn't that sound kind of like equanimity? Isn't that sweet? He purifies his mind from restlessness and anxiety. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. Having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of mind that weaken wisdom, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana. Again, the word jhana is considered to be a bad kind of meditation. Jhana actually means a level of understanding. That's one of the Pali translations of it. But if you talk to people that you've been practicing jhana, they're going to look at you and be frightened of you. We were talking about this morning. Instead of talking about to other people about your jhana practice, talk to them about your serenity practice. And when you talk about serenity, that doesn't scare them so much. With the stilling of thinking and examining thought, he enters upon and abides in the second jhana. With the fading away of joy, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, he enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, excuse me, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not lust after it if it's pleasing. He does not dislike it if it's unpleasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body established, with immeasurable mind. Immeasurable mind means one of the Brahma-viharas. He understands as it actually is the deliverance of mind, and deliverance by wisdom, wherein these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having thus abandoned favoring and opposing, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant, he does not delight in that feeling, welcome it, and remain holding to it. As he does not do so, delight in feeling ceases in him. With the cessation of his delight comes the cessation of craving. With the cessation of craving, cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of being, of habitual tendency. With the cessation of habitual tendency, cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with mind, he does not lust after it if it's pleasing. He does not dislike it if it's unpleasing. With the cessation of his delight comes the cessation of craving. With the cessation of craving, cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of habitual tendency. With the cessation of habitual tendency, cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Monks, remember this discourse of mine as briefly as deliverance of the destruction of craving. But remember, the monk Sati, son of a fisherman, as caught up in a vast net of craving, in a trammel of craving. That's what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Now I'm going to go to another section in the Samyutta Nikaya. And it's a real interesting thing. A lot of people that read about the Buddha and dependent origination on the night of his awakening, and he spent a whole week going forwards with part of the dependent origination and backwards, and both backwards and forwards. And they have the idea that the Buddha on the night of his awakening, he just all of a sudden understood this. But this particular sutta, it says, monks, before my awakening, while I was still only a bodhisattva, not yet awakened, it occurred to me, alas, the world has fallen into trouble, in that it is born ages and dies. It passes away and is reborn, yet it does not understand the escape from this suffering, headed by aging and death. When now will an escape be discerned from this suffering, headed by aging and death? Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does aging and death come to be? By what is age and death conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is birth, aging and death comes to be. Aging and death has birth as its condition. Then it occurred to me, when what exists does birth come to be? By what is birth conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is habitual tendency, birth comes to be. Birth has habitual tendency as condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does habitual tendency come to be? By what is habitual tendency conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is clinging, habitual tendency comes to be. Habitual tendency has clinging as condition. Then it occurred to me, when what exists does clinging come to be? By what is clinging conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is craving, clinging comes to be. Clinging has craving as condition. And he goes through all of the links of dependent origination. Now, he knew this intellectually, but he hadn't realized it. And he sat with meditation and he saw, yeah, this is how it works. But as he started using right effort more and more, he, on the night of his awakening, he realized it. That was the big oh wow. So he understood all of the links of dependent origination, how they originate and how they cease. He knew it intellectually, but then he had to practice for a little while before he realized it. So just memorizing the links isn't enough. You have to see it for yourself. Now, a lot of you are getting real good at being able to recognize feeling and craving and clinging and habitual tendency and so on. And you're starting to let go of that by using the six R's. You're purifying your mind. And that makes me happy. Don't get caught up in the stories. Don't get caught up in the mental proliferation. Let it be. Relax. Smile. Come back to your object of meditation. Oh, but my mind runs back to that. I don't care. Do it again. Use the 6 R's again. This is the path that you've been looking for. And it's not my path. It is the Buddha's path. And you see me reading this, it's not my words even. This is the Buddha's words. Sometimes with a little adjustment by me. But the more you are able to observe how mind's attention moves and let go and relax, your mind then becomes exceptionally clear and bright. You're full of understanding how this process works. And you bring that pure mind back to something wholesome, smiling, and your object of meditation. Stay with your object of meditation for as long as you can. Now, I started hearing a little bit of the B word today. I'm bored. Who's bored? Who wants some excitement in their meditation? It's boring. There's just nothing there. That's great. That's not just regular good. But I want. Whose mindfulness has disappeared? Mine, because I'm bored? Yeah, but there's nothing there. I'm calling this the Brenda syndrome. Brenda is the teacher in Indonesia. She's my translator. And every time I go there, I make her laugh really loud because I always mention that it took her 3 years to let go of the idea that mine was supposed to be active. 3 years.
Are you going to put an entry in your next book for Brenda syndrome and describe it?
I think so. Yeah. But I had another student that it took 7 years for them to stop following things and going, quote, to the end of them. I was at a complete loss as what to say, because I kept saying the same thing over and over and over again. And every time he came, I knew that he was going to finally get through. But then he'd be sitting and there would be a past memory come up and he would start following that past memory. Where does it go? What was the cause of this? Why did this happen? That's psychology. That's therapies. That's not the Buddha's teaching. Finally, after 7 years, he finally started developing some disenchantment with following things. And it didn't take him very long to get really successful with his practice. Don't experiment. don't look around the edges to see if you can do something better. Stay with your object of meditation. Don't change that. Don't try to come up with something better. I mean, this is the Buddha's teaching. He's the best one around. So, you're trying to experiment and make things better or easier, or your curiosity comes up and you say, well, I got to follow this one. You're not following the directions. You're not following the six R's truly and honestly. So, just stay with the six R's. You'll be able to sit for long periods of time when there's absolutely nothing. It's just like a black hole. There's nothing there. But you might be able to sit in that for an hour, 2 hours. What relief there is in that. Your mind is exceptionally clear and bright. This is a good thing, because your mind is at its purest. There is no craving in your mind at that time. Well, when is Nibbana going to come? Whenever it wants to, when the conditions are right. If you have a slight desire for Nibbana to occur, you can better believe it's not gonna. Why do you hear me say before you sit, tell yourself, it doesn't matter what happens in the sitting. Don't care. Whatever it is, my job is just to observe. Not to want anything to happen. Just observe and see what happens. Do you know what's going to happen in 10 minutes? Well, why try to project what you want to happen in 10 minutes? You have to let go of those kind of subtle desires. Just observe. And you have to observe with some interest, or else you'll dull out. And then you start having all of these different thoughts coming up because you're not catching as soon as they start arising. The advantage of having this very, very peaceful, calm mind is you can see these things starting to come up in a very subtle little way, and then they get a little bit bigger. And if you don't 6R, you're going to get caught up in restlessness. Seeing how this process works in its finest is being in neither perception nor non-perception. And catching the slightest little tiny movement. There's true contentment that comes in your daily life when you have the experience of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. When you have relief coming up, when you have the ability to see these little tiny flicks of things coming up, you won't recognize it as dependent origination, but it's there. And you'll see for yourself that everything is impersonal. You don't have anything to do with any of this. There's so much relief in that. And that leads to a different perspective of the way you see the world. Because you're not going to break a precept. You're not going to tell a little white lie. You're not going to try to deceive the world in any way. You're going to be able to be the example for other people. And that's important. So the more you can do this and stay with your object of meditation, and if your mind starts to get bored, you have to realize that your mind has already started moving and you didn't see it because you started dulling out. You have to sharpen up your mindfulness so you could see it coming. No more B words, please. I had two B words today that happened. But and bored. And we had to get the but out of the way. And we have to get the bored out of the way. You'll like it when you do. You'll start to understand more and more easily how this process works without getting caught by liking and disliking, by seeing it as it actually is. It's only this hindrance. That's all it is. The hindrances like to gang up on you. They don't like to just, they don't like to come one at a time. They like to come up and gang up on you. You start to get restless, and I don't like that. So now you have two hindrances to deal with. But you can get rid of both of them by just six-R-ing and not getting involved in past habitual tendencies. I had a friend that when I first came to Missouri, we would sit in a meditation room and we had a clock that ticked loudly. Every day he would come in and he would take the battery out, put the clock on a step. And every day I would come back in, put the battery in, and put it back up where it was supposed to go. I don't like noise. I don't care whether you like noise or not. But it kind of boinks me. Well, what does that say? That's saying that his concentration is too deep. His mindfulness is not deep enough. He's out of balance with his mindfulness and his concentration. Because sound is just sound. What difference does it make? I learned that one in a major way in Burma. I'd be sitting in meditation and, oh, I was really going deep. Somebody would come up and they would say, Saida wants to see you. Whoa! What? Stop doing that! And Saida would just kind of giggle and I'd say, he shocked me when he said something. I was going so good. And he's the one that told me that my mindfulness was not very good. And he was right. And just to make a point, he decided it was time during the range retreat to drill a well right outside the meditation hall with an old motor that didn't have a real good muffler on it. started at 7:30 in the morning, went to 6 o'clock at night. Continually. Bhante, can't you find somewhere else to drill that well? No, it's got to be here. He didn't find any water either. I thought that was kind of funny. But I had 3 months of continual noise until 6 o'clock, and then it was quiet for about half an hour, and then tea shops started showing up. They were right outside the wall for the meditation hall. And they brought their loudspeakers and their cassettes, and they were playing all kinds of music until about 10 o'clock at night, when we were supposed to be going to bed. And then it was quiet for a little while. And I would be the only one in the meditation hall. That was a good time for me to meditate until about 11 o'clock. And then the next door neighbor turned on his generator. And he ran the generator all night. I had to be able to accept the fact that there is a lot of noises in the world, and you have to accept the fact that they're there. But you can't try to stop it. You can't try to make it go away. You have to accept it. You have to give up your aversion to having something happen like that. So I also had the great experience of being in a culture where they like to clear their throat by hawking. I mean, loud. And then they would spit loud. And I'm thinking, oh man, why did I come here? This was at Mahasi Center. This is the place in the world for meditation. And these guys are hawking and making all kinds of noise. Then when I came back to Burma a second time, I did a 2-year retreat there. There were sometimes villagers would come in and they'd want to do meditation for a little while. And they would get bored and they would start belching. And some guys, I mean, I've really got to appreciate their skill. Because these guys could really belch, and they belched really loud. And when they did their walking meditation, every step they had a loud belch. And they liked to pass gas. And you know how you come here, it's super quiet. When I walk into the meditation hall, there'd be 2 or 3 people belching, and they'd get up and walk around. They'd start talking with each other. And I've done a lot of meditation where I was in quiet places and everybody respected that. But that's their culture. What can I do? All I can do is get rid of it, get used to it, not complain to anybody. But just learn to accept the fact that what happens in the present moment has to be okay, because that's the truth. You can fight with the truth all you want. You can make yourself suffer with the truth all you want. Or you can 6R it and let it go. Just let it be. So, Do you have any questions?
Bhante, if you could tell us the actual meaning of formations.
Preparations. It says right there.
But I don't understand what it means by in-breathing and out-breathing the body formations.
What is a formation? Look on the thing and tell me what the formations are.
Body, speech, and mind.
Okay. There's the preparations. That's the potential for these things to arise. If you don't have a body, are you going to breathe?
But in each moment you already have a body.
Do you?
I think so. As far as I wish.
It's always arising and passing away. It's birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Continually at all of the sense doors. Is your body solid?
Yes.
Is it? What happens when you get in a microscope and start looking at your body very deeply? Is it solid?
I guess not.
So? You have the potential for these things to arise. When conditions are right, they will arise on their own. Do you always have speech? Do you always have mind? You think? When you get into neither perception nor non-perception, tell me what you're looking at. When you get into an unconditioned state, tell me where the mind is. Somebody else had a question? Yeah.
Does this last sutta that you read about the awakening have a number?
It is in chapter number 12, the Nidana Samyutta. This is a chapter on Nidana Samyutta. It's called the Book of Causation. It is number one, origination.
Do you look at those books during the day?
No, not during retreat. Okay. This book here is a bad sense of humor. This was five books. Bhikkhu Bodhi put it all into one book. So it's real heavy to carry around. But there's a lot in it that's really fascinating. This is called the Book of Connections, or Connectedness. So there's a whole bunch of suttas about all different kinds of topics. Like the awakening factors, there must be 70 or 80 different suttas just on the awakening factors. Or the five aggregates, there must be over 100 suttas just on that. So it's real easy to go to that. And if you want to find out what the Buddha said about dependent origination, there's 90 or 84 suttas on that. So you got 84 suttas just talking about dependent origination. And if you pick a topic, it's pretty interesting. Yeah.
So to navigate it, you use the index?
His indexes are really complicated. You do your best. That's all I can say. Yeah.
I'm just curious, how long did it take Rupa Bodhi to write those books? And is he going to do any more in the future?
He's not going to do any more of the Nikaya. Which is too bad, because the guy that wrote the Digha Nikaya was an Englishman that had no practice. He just did a translation, and it's not very clear with his translation. It took him 10 years to write this book, the Samyutta Nikaya. During that 10 years, he took 2 years out to write the middling sayings. And he's written the Anguttara Nikaya, but he left out a lot of suttas. A lot.
Are they your favorite
these two
translations
so far? And Leo, yeah. What he's doing right now is he's going to the Agamas, which are the Chinese the Chinese suttas, and he's comparing them with this form of the Nikayas and seeing which ones agree with each other. Analeo is a very interesting guy.
You can take his, you can go online and listen to his lectures that he publishes online, and you can follow along in one of his courses. And
yeah.
He goes through the Pali text and the Chinese text, and he compares them.
Yeah.
And there's really a lot of similarities. You think they might be wildly different, but they're actually kind of wildly similar.
Yeah.
And so, you think a lot would be lost, but it's very, very much intact. It's very impressive. And he's just brilliant. And he's fun. And at the end he says, and what did we learn from this? I mean, you bring it right back to reality. He's very, very good. Look him up, the Heidelberg.
And he teaches from the Visuddhimagga. When he teaches meditation, he teaches Visuddhimagga meditation. When he wrote a book on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, they got very popular. And I saw an article about him in, I think, Tricycle magazine. And I started getting in touch with him with emails and that sort of thing. And I told him that I'd written a book on mindfulness of breathing. He might want to take a look at it. And he used that as one of his reference books in the back of his book. And he was real enthusiastic about possibly coming to America to do some practice with me. And I've gotten in touch with him two or three times since, and he's changed his mind. So, oh well. Yeah.
lust, hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt.
In Sutta 128, Pachamukha 128, it mentions that there is a radiance of meditation object by Venerable Ayurveda. So what does that mean?
You become radiant when you're doing the meditation. I don't use Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation 100%. Because it's misleading, some of the translation. He took that from Jnanamoli. And Sutta number 128, when you hear me say, and object of meditation, that's not what it says in the book. The word in Pali for radiance is obasa. But and in Pali, it's mentioned a few times in suttas, but he doesn't take it as radiance. And it gets real confusing sometimes, some of his translation. But by and large, it's the best one around. So, yeah.
Is there an antidote list for the 12 links? The 12 positive qualities that balance these out?
They are all a form of suffering. The positive quality that cancels them out is called the 6 R's. There are some people that write about the five hindrances and they try to make it some kind of positive thing, but the hindrances are a hindrance and it's not a positive thing. You can try to come up with some positive about it, but the truth is, that's misleading. You have to call a spade pretty close.
I've seen somebody take the jhana factors and say how each of them breaks one of the hindrances.
Yeah, the first jhana stops the five hindrances from arising as long as your mindfulness is good. When your mindfulness gets weak, then one of these hindrances pop up. But they're necessary. That's why they're in the four foundations of mindfulness. They're a necessary part of the practice because that's where your attachments really are stored. So every time you 6R that, it gets weaker and lesser. And that's why as you go deeper and you go through the experience of Nibbana a few times, the lust and hate disappear because you're purifying your mind so much with the 6 R's. That's why doubt disappears. So trying to put a positive spin on something that's negative, I'm not in full agreement with something like that.
So, can I think of dependent origination as the hard wiring?
Yes.
For experience. And once you cut it, or at least enough, at tamha, at craving, that the whole hard wiring
part of it falls apart.
Part of it falls apart.
Yeah. The clinging, the habitual tendency, birth, death, aging.
But the potential parts are still there.
Yeah.
The Namaru, the sixth phase, the feeling.
But as you continue on, you get to see those. And six are those. And then everything after that just doesn't arise anymore.
For the, for persons who experience first path, second path, third path, they would essentially that part after feeling or craving comes up, that stops coming up more and more. So, and purity is, I mean, I'm just trying to get this straight in my head. And the purity is it just comes up less and less. And the less it actually spontaneously provokes the birth of action and suffering arises, as that happens less and less.
Right. That's why you get purity. That's why you get more and more happy as you go deeper in this.
And while you meditate.
And while you meditate. Right. Staying on your object of meditation is most important because you don't have the hindrances come up when your mindfulness is good.
As a question I was thinking about, the suttas often make reference to the monks. You mentioned that the Buddha designed the practice for the farmers.
He designed it for human beings.
Jordan speaking, how that would be very effective for somebody who, a farmer, who just took it that far.
Right. There was a lot of sotapannas during the time of the Buddha. A lot. And they became sotapannas by listening to him and understanding what he was talking about. Or they started doing some meditation. And because they were simple and they kept their precepts, their progress in meditation was fantastic. It was really good.
Was it a happier time? Was there less war? Was it more like?
It was pretty much the same. They still had one king that wanted to take over another kingdom because of this or that reason. They had a grudge against them or something. One of the main kings was Ajatasattu, and he was going to war with all kinds of different people. But he's also responsible for killing his father. And because of that action, he could never attain Nibbana in that lifetime. He was bound for a really nasty hell.
The king didn't practice meditation.
King Bimbisara was a sotapanna. He was the father of Ajatasattu. Yeah.
I just think that probably part of the reason that there's such references to monks is that the monastic community was the one that kept the teachings.
Yeah.
And they were the ones that passed it on from generation up through the centuries.
Well, it's that, and the Buddha was hanging around the monks a lot, and he gave a lot of discourses to the monks. It doesn't mean that as a layman, you couldn't come and listen. You could, but it was mostly directed at the monks because that's who he was talking to. Yeah.
And did you say last night that there was a written language for quite a while, but the monks chose not to write down the sutras?
Right. It's much more accurate to do it by oral tradition.
Do you know how long there was a written language, but they weren't writing it down?
I think the Brahmins were writing stuff down quite a bit.
Yeah, thousands of years.
Yeah.
I mean, there was all the Upanishads and the Rig Veda and, they had volumes.
So there was a written language during the time.
Oh, sure.
The Sanskrit.
The famous Mahabharata was, at least written down 1,000 years before the Buddha. I mean, the Mahabharata is now pegged at about 3,500 BC when it actually occurred, that war. But they really don't know, but they're finding out, archaeologists are finding out that the timeline is moving back further than they first thought. Yeah, it's been a long time we've had written something.
And in the place in the north of India, that was just their tradition not to have things written down. Unless you were a Brahmin, and you had to be educated to be a Brahmin. It was like their secret teachings. In Burma today, you have to, as a monk, if you want to be successful as a teacher, you have to memorize about this many books. Yeah. And you have to take a test on it before you're 26, 28, I think. So you're a monk from 20, so you have 8 years to memorize this many books, and you get 1 year to take the tests. And my teacher, Usilananda, took the oral test, and it goes like this. Okay, this is a sutta on the shorter discourse of Satchika. This is verse number 10. And I would read one sentence. You continue. You're only allowed to make 6 mistakes. If you make 6 mistakes, you fail. He didn't make any mistakes. And there is also a very comprehensive written part of this. And it's about the Pali language and how to use the Pali language and that sort of thing. And Usilananda wrote the whole thing in Pali, explaining Pali. And he didn't make any mistakes on that either. He was number one in the country. He was the brightest man I've ever been around. Well, almost. There was one other monk that I happened to meet, and I spent some time with him. He was the monk that in 1954 took a test on the entire Tipitaka. And he memorized the entire Tipitaka. And you know how you take a test in college and you have a 4-hour test and you feel like you've been wrung out? Well, he took a test 10 hours a day, 30 days in a row, and got no less than 90% correct. He was in the World Book of Records for best retentive memory. And I got to hang out with him a little while. Through a translator, of course. I asked him some pretty direct questions about where does it talk in the suttas about neighborhood concentration. Doesn't talk in the suttas about neighborhood concentration. Where does it, what commentary does it talk about that? And as Visuddhimagga. So I got to ask him a lot of interesting questions. But he was getting close to death at that time. The last time I saw him a couple times. The last time I saw him, he was probably around 50 pounds. He was just skin and bone. And I went in to pay my respects to him. And as soon as I walked in the door, he started radiating loving kindness to me. So we were just having a great love fest while I was there. And I walked out with this other monk that was doing the translation for me. And he said, "What were you doing in there?" I was radiating loving kindness to him. Wow, that really felt nice. But he had the best memory of anybody that I ever knew. And now in Burma, they have 15 or 17 monks that have done that. And it took him 17 years to memorize the entire Tipitaka and have it. I mean, really have it good. And that turned into a competition with the other monks. And now they can do it in only 9 years.
And so that's when they get to the kind of equivalent of PhD level, presumably, where they're...
No, that's very far beyond PhD. What Usil Ananda did, he has a title behind his name, Bivamsa. Bivamsa is like PhD. Mm-hmm. And that's just memorizing 12 books.
Wow. And would these individuals typically start by being taught by other people, but then take over their own self-teaching and memorization process?
Yeah, it's a combination of that. Yeah. But they don't explain what a lot of the stuff they have to memorize. You have to come up with that on your own or go and listen to other people talk about it.
So they can just quote it, but they can't necessarily analyze it and provide an analysis.
Not necessarily, unless they get to be older monks, and then they are able to do that. They get it figured out. While I was in Burma, I was staying at this place where there was a 9-year-old boy, and he had memorized the first book of Abhidhamma. And I thought that was cruelty. Because they didn't explain anything about it. They just had him memorize it. So he was just reciting words. He didn't know what they meant. But now I would imagine that he does. That's been more than 20 years ago, so... Now he understands it.
Can you say just a little bit what's going on in Burma now with the politics?
I don't know. I've been removed from that for a long time. And when I see Burmese monks, we don't talk about that sort of thing. We start talking about Dhamma. I went there 3 years ago, 4 years ago, something like that. And I was completely shocked because I went to the meditation center that I had stayed at for 2 years. And it was, when I was there, they just put in a 4-lane road. But there was bare fields around and all of this kind of thing. And I go into Burma and they had gas stations. If you had to buy gas, you bought it in a 1-liter bottle and they'd fill it up for you when I was there. And they had hotels. And they had new cars. This one guy drove his 1943 Jeep into the monastery and he hit a bump into wheel fell off, so I had helped him jack it up and fix the wheel so it worked again. But they, and all their buses are from World War II. But now they're starting to get pretty fancy. And there's a lot of Western things that are starting to filter in, but that's only on certain roads. You go off the beaten track, it's just like Burma was when I was there. They still had the shops in the same way and that sort of thing. But I was real impressed. They in Rangoon, they don't allow any 2 or 3 wheel vehicles on the road in the city. And that really makes it nice, because people that can't afford a car, they get a little Honda 50 or something like that, and they really create traffic problems. And they don't have that in Rangoon. I thought that was just great. And to see a gas station, I mean, that was like, wow. And hotels. They had, I think they had 2 hotels in Burma.
Yeah, they had the, what do they call it, the Strand or the Stafford, that old white one.
Yeah.
And then they had one out of town.
Yeah.
When I was there, they didn't even have a stoplight. In fact, they just had a couple of, just they probably had a dozen streetlights in all of downtown.
Yeah.
And the cars would drive at night, they wouldn't turn on their lights because they didn't have it.
Or they didn't want to run down their battery.
Right. And they would coast the car, they were going downhill, they'd shut off the engine. Yeah, it's just poverty.
It was a real interesting experience being there for 2 years.
What was their attitude towards you as a visitor?
I was a dignitary. I got invited to all kinds of very famous monks. And they would ask me to give a Dhamma talk, but they didn't have anybody to translate. But they would sit there and listen, not knowing what I said. And going out on alms run was really amazing. If I was in town, I started going out on alms run with another monk. We just kind of went our own way. And when we started, we had 3 houses that we went to. In a week, we had 15. And I had to carry another bag to put the food in. And always coming back, we stopped at this one place. They begged us to stop. And they grew these papaya that were like footballs. I mean, it was 3 or 4 pound papaya. And I was always thankful that all I had to do was cross the street and then I could get rid of that weight because of the papayas that they kept giving me every day. But they knew that I was at that monastery. And whenever I walked in, I would just dump all the food and give it to the people that prepared the food, and everybody had some. Everybody got to eat some. So,
you must have been so distinct from them physiologically.
Oh, yeah.
6 foot something, you know, whatever pounded, orange-haired guy from the West.
That's right.
Everybody's about, what, 5 foot six or something like
that. Well, some of the Burmese were really tall. There was one Burmese monk that was taller than I was. And he was from the warrior class. The warrior class were generally bigger.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
They got rid of the
really tiny
warriors because
they. Yeah, but eating food in Burma is not an easy thing because they put that much oil on everything.
During the day, there was a layer of oil on the big pot, and it would sit there all day, and then they would stir it up and part the oil and put it on your plate.
what was the plant that was the source of that oil?
Mostly peanut. But it was so hot and humid, they didn't have peanut butter because it would mold really fast, and that's deadly. But they had some great stuff. They had tea leaves that were fermented. La Pet. I love that stuff. It's really good. And of course there was a lot of beetle that people were chewing. And if you get tired of chewing it, you don't throw it away, you give it to somebody else to chew. That's true. When I first got there, a monk gave me some beetle. And I've heard about beetle, you know. So I take some beetle, it's leaves. And in it, they roll up and put tobacco in it, a little bit, not a lot. And they have this white paste that's very, it's very much like cinnamon. And as soon as I put that in my mouth, I had to spit. I mean, it just made my mouth start watering. And it wasn't particularly good. So I didn't take any more after that. I wasn't interested in beetle. But you see some people and their teeth were actually black from eating beetle. And they were spitting this red spit all over everywhere. And I was in a monastery with this monk and he just put some beetle in his mouth and we go in and we're talking with other monks, and before long I'm seeing him going like this, and he's going and everybody understood him because he had so much spit in his mouth. When he came out, you know, I didn't want to stand around him because when he was going to spit, it's going to splash everywhere. Anyway.
And in your most recent trip there, if you compared what people seem to be like, are they happier or less happy, or what would you say their state of the average folks there?
The big cities are pretty much big cities anywhere. It doesn't matter what culture you're in. You go out into the country and they're always giggling and laughing. And you go out into the country, you don't see any vehicles anymore. What you see is ox carts.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Just like it was 150 or 200 years ago.
So it's declined economically in a way?
No, it's picking up. They're starting to get electricity in all the towns and villages and that sort of thing. Sometimes it even works. But that's where I met this one monk. He was 102 years old. Didn't wear glasses. He had great hearing. I mean, he could hear somebody walking from a long distance away. And he never had electricity in his kuti. He had just had a candle. But he was there when I walked in. He was there reading by the candle. And he had great eyesight. He lived to be about 106. Yeah. Quite famous. And in Burma, did you ever run across in Sri Lanka Ananda Maitreya?
No.
he might have died before you got there. I met him in 93 or something like that. He was 97 years old at the time, running up and down stairs like you couldn't believe. Super energetic, very, very famous monk. He was Bhikkhu Bodhi's Upachaya, that means spiritual father, and he taught Bhikkhu Bodhi the Pali. And he was 100, I think he was about 105, 106, and he wanted to go up to a monastery because he started writing a Pali to Pali dictionary. And there was one book that he wanted to get. And he knew that, he knew exactly where it was, but so he didn't want anybody else to go get it. And when he came back, he just got the book and just opened it and then had a heart attack and died. But he was a real amazing monk too. I've been really lucky to run across a very, very famous monks.
What does the Pali to Pali dictionary do?
It explained different words in Pali with Pali.
Oh, okay.
Just like a dictionary.
Just like an English dictionary. It's really too complex of a concept.
Okay, why don't we share some merit then? May suffering ones be suffering free and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas, the mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.